This is Behind the Pixels.
With me is Sarah Weldon on the other end of a Skype call, and I'm not even going to attempt to explain who Sarah is and the craziness that she has taken it upon herself to undertake next year. I'm going to let Sarah do that. Sarah, welcome to Behind the Pixels, and can you tell people about this extraordinary thing that you're going to be doing?
Well, we're four girls. We're called Four Birds Boating. And we basically met in the Republic of Georgia. We were teaching English as a foreign language. And we kind of had this crazy idea. We saw the very first Pacific Ocean rowing race organised. And we thought, what a brilliant way to kind of set ourselves a personal challenge. And whilst at sea, to use it as a platform for teaching English and kind of science, technology, engineering, maths, geography to kids worldwide, life on the boat. So we set off from Monterey Bay, California on the 7th of June 2014, and we'll row over 7,200 nautical miles to Honolulu, Hawaii as part of the race, and from there on to Cairns, Australia, unsupported and kind of alone. So quite a big challenge.
And so that journey is going to take you 8 months all told?
Pretty much, yeah. That's kind of what we've budgeted for. So it depends on currents and how fast we row as well.
So if I get this right, you are going to be rowing a school across the ocean.
That's a nice way of putting it, yes. Pretty much. Yeah, an online classroom. So bringing the ocean alive to young people.
What kind of things are you going to be doing then to do that, to achieve that, because you'll be rowing, and there's a whole bunch of questions I want to speak to you about that. But just on the digital storytelling from the ocean, the education from the ocean, what kind of things can we expect?
Well, at the moment, we're working with a local school in my hometown, Henley-on-Thames, and we're working with young people to raise funds to provide iPads for some different projects in different countries, developing countries. I think we've got 48 projects at the moment. Each of those projects will receive an iPad. And then the local kids in the UK are also turning their lessons into worksheets and kind of little film clips as well. So they'll all be uploaded onto our online classroom. So we've got WizIQ based in India and a bigger platform called Frog, which is where we'll kind of upload all the worksheets and the videos as well. So we'll kind of give them a grounding in science, technology, engineering, maths, geography. And then when we set out on the row, we'll visit schools in Monterey Bay, in the area there. And through Skype, all of the students following us will be able to log on and ask questions to those students. Likewise, when we get to Hawaii, we'll go and visit lots of schools across Hawaii and also in Australia. And then on the way home, we're visiting 4,000 orphans who are supported by one of the charities that we're raising funds for, which is called the Thai Children's Trust. So we'll go and visit those 4,000 orphans there as well. So that's kind of the one part, really, is the provision of the online classroom. And then actually, while we're at sea, they can log on to the classroom. We'll be posting videos on there, some 3D film as well of different flora and fauna. We're collecting scientific research, which they'll also be able to replicate in their schools, and they can follow us through the classroom. We have a tracking device on the boat, so they'll be able to see where we are, and then they can link that back to a special map that we've designed for them. And then the schools will get postcards as well, so they can stick those to their maps. So quite a range of different things, really.
What kind of experiments will you be doing while you're out there on the ocean?
We're basically collecting data on water quality, weather, plastic pollution, documenting any kind of plastic pollution, marine debris. We're collecting data on any whale, dolphin, like cetacean sightings. And we're also collecting physiology and psychology data on ourselves as the rowers, because it's going to be quite a big challenge. And it's going to be quite interesting to see how we kind of change and how our bodies adapt to the situation we're in.
That's for sure, and that's a whole other set of questions. Before we move on to that, let's just one final kind of scientific thing. This plastic issue. Now, there is photography available of the decomposed bodies of large seabirds on islands.
Yeah.
And you can see the outline of the decomposed body. And of course, because it's decomposed, you can see what was in their stomachs.
Yeah.
And it is actually quite shocking to see these birds are just stuffed with plastic. Can you just talk about, is that the kind of thing you're going to be covering as well? These big sort of floating islands of plastic mass in the sea?
Yeah, it's actually, we're kind of collecting different bits of data, really driven by, we followed Ros Savage, who's one of our patrons. We followed her as she rowed across the Indian Ocean. And through the kind of footage that she sent back, we were quite horrified at, you know, kind of the issues that we were seeing. And that was really important for us in Georgia, because we suddenly had a population of people who used lots of plastic bags, and they were putting them in the river because there was no refuse collection service. And when we were talking to different families, we asked them, you know, well, what happens to the plastic? And they said, well, it floats away. You know, that's why we put it in the river, because then it floats away. But there wasn't really a concept of what happens to it afterwards. We tried to, you know, kind of bring true this kind of idea of, you know, actually the world's oceans are all connected to each other. So in Georgia, the Black Sea connects to the Mediterranean Sea, which connects to the Atlantic Ocean into the world oceans. So actually what we do on a local level has a really big impact kind of on the planet. So really just trying to bring back this idea of changing our behaviour on a local level and hopefully making a difference globally, so we're not contributing to these big five gyres in the Pacific Ocean, for example, where all the plastic ends up. And I think one of the gyres has a layer of plastic which is the size of Texas or something completely crazy. One of the things is to document that, really, and encourage our young people to not use plastic overly.
It's a shocking thing that you touch upon there, and of course it's hidden away because it is in the middle of this huge ocean that we're just not aware of for the most part, I suppose. Let's just talk about, first of all, for those people who've never seen an ocean going rowboat, we're not talking about one of these skiffs that goes up, or an eight that we see in the Oxford Boat Race. That's not what we're talking about here, is it?
No. Our boat's actually 23 foot long and 6 foot wide. It has a very tiny cabin where the four of us will kind of hide from the elements when the weather gets really rough. But it isn't, we can't stretch out, for example, so it isn't that big. And the boat itself is actually made from a kind of carbon composite material, so it's a much lighter boat than usual. So yeah, that's kind of the general structure. It's not very big.
And so there's going to be four of you, and this cabin area, how big is the cabin area then, if it can seat or at least house the four of you?
I can't remember the exact measurements. It hasn't actually been built yet, but it will be built very soon. But you can't actually sit up in it. So you can't stretch out, you can't sit up. It's literally, we would be, when we are four of us in there, we'll be kind of leaning on each other. And when we're in there during the bad weather, we have to wear harnesses. So we'll be attached to, you know, kind of the cabin to make sure that when we roll, we're not going to bump our heads and things. So it's not going to be that comfortable. But you can probably think of it more as a sauna, because you can't open any vents or hatches, because if you did capsize, the water would come in. So you have to keep them closed all the time. So it's a little bit like a sweat box, I suppose.
You're sketching my vision of hell there, Sarah, to be honest with you. Now, I know, and we'll talk about your particular fear, because I know I saw a video in which you spoke very openly about the thing that's going to sort of, you're most afraid of, but you've just sketched for me a situation where the four of you are in this tiny space, sort of squeezed up against each other. You're in rough weather. It's just you and however thick this boat is going to be between you and the Pacific Ocean, which does not justify its name, because it can be a really rough ocean.
Yeah.
Does that not fill you with some trepidation? That to me would be my main sort of worry, that I'd be in this confined space with three other people, maybe even be feeling quite seasick.
I think actually for me, it's one of the great things about us designing the boat and working with a special yachtsman to design it, and also the process of building it, is that actually this vessel, it becomes almost like a person. It becomes something that we're very attached to, literally and kind of metaphorically. So as long as we stay by that boat and we're attached to it the whole time, that is our life raft. And as long as we're attached to that boat, we'll be safe. So it is, you know, it's not going to be fantastic. It's not going to be ideal, obviously, in the bad weather. But providing we look after that boat and we stay attached to it, it's going to look after us and it's going to keep us safe and alive. So yeah, it's a kind of a strange relationship with the boat. I'm sure we'll hate it at the end, but while we're there, it is our lifeline.
Talking about that kind of emotion, there are four of you on this very small vessel, and it's not like if you have a fight, you can walk off and find a quiet corner. You're very much on top of each other. Now, I have a teeny, teeny, teeny bit of experience of this. I did a canoe race from Devizes to Westminster, and there were two of us in the boat, and there was a lot of training, and occasionally one of us would get grumpy. But when it came to race day, it was still only 24 hours that we were in the boat together. You're in this boat for 8 months. How are you anticipating that kind of thing? Because, you know, is it going to be a case where you come to the end in Australia and there's only like one of you left and the other three mysteriously fell overboard while shaving?
Hopefully not. I mean, I guess that's why it's so important that we train together now. We're already 18 months in the planning for this ocean row, so we already know each other pretty well. We're putting ourselves through a lot of kind of intense situations together at the moment, but obviously no matter how much we train, we're not going to be able to kind of replicate exactly what it'll be like when we get to sea. We're not really going to know exactly how we'll cope when we get there. We are working with some sports psychologists, and we've been pretty good at sketching out different scenarios and talking about how we might deal with them and what things, you know, are going to affect us personally the most and how we might deal with those. But I think probably the best kind of preparation for that is talking to other ocean rowers. And again, we've been talking to our patron Ross Savage, and probably the best bit of advice she's given us is the line, leave it on the wave behind. So if you do fall out, that, you know, you just have to get over it and move on. You can't be carrying things with you, because then you would hold grudges and you would really fall out. So it's really about we've got to be there for each other no matter what. It's kind of about communication as well, just making sure that we say, you know, actually, guys, I'm having a really bad day today, just ignore me. And we do kind of have the cabin on at times that we can kind of just go and have a little bit of downtime. But even though we are four of us on the boat, I think it's going to be pretty much a mental challenge anyway. And while we're rowing, we will probably just switch off and kind of go into our heads a little bit and just be with our own thoughts. So it's just trying to balance it, really.
Just a last question on the mental side. The rough weather would be a concern for most people, but yeah, you've expressed another worry, which I thought was really interesting, and I can actually totally buy into, because if it happened to me, I would completely freak out. What's your big fear crossing the ocean?
I'm kind of alone in this, because the other girls were afraid of the big waves, which I'm kind of looking forward to in a weird way. But for me, my biggest fear is every week when we climb out of the boat and we go underneath it to clean the kind of barnacles and things off the bottom. And I don't really know what I'm afraid of. It's kind of that what lies beneath. So I guess it's kind of an innate fear, but also quite irrational, because it's probably the least of our worries. And it's not that I'm afraid. We're actually rowing across an area known as the Great White Cafe, where all the great white sharks hang out. And I'm not afraid of sharks. I love scuba diving with sharks. And if I'm under the water, I'm fine. It's just I don't like being on the surface. It's almost like I'm kind of afraid of aliens or something. It's that complete unknown, and when your imagination just goes wild and you start wondering what could be beneath you. I'm actually trying to get over that at the moment just by doing a lot of outdoor swimming, just things like having the, you know, bits of weed kind of touching you as you swim, and trying to swim over areas of kind of lots of weeds, and swimming at night as well, swimming in the dark. Because it really is, it's like a battle with your own imagination, because it's not that I'm afraid of anything in particular. It's just that kind of when your brain starts going a little bit crazy and going, ooh, I wonder what's down there. Yeah, probably it's probably the least likely thing that we should be worried about. But yeah, it's definitely my worry.
I can totally identify with that. Don't worry, I get that. I get that completely. In terms of downtime, what will you be able to do to switch? I mean, how many hours will you row and how many hours will you have off?
We'll likely row for about 2 hours at a time. But the way we've structured it, we'll probably end up, instead of, because there are four of us, we don't want to end up with a kind of two and two divide. So we'll probably actually schedule it that we'll spend an hour with each different person. So we should get roughly 3 hours off in between rowing. But one of the really important things to me, and again from speaking to other rowers, was trying to get some kind of downtime together. And one of the ways we can do that is by, for example, stopping rowing and eating together, and then having things like themed nights. So perhaps every Friday night we'll do some kind of silly activity, or, you know, like, let's have a Mexican evening, or let's have a, you know, American evening or something. And then just, you know, perhaps putting different tunes on the iPod, maybe eating some different food, and then having friends just pack different things to kind of keep us entertained. So those kind of silly moments are the ones that are going to make or break the team. So yeah, just trying to think of things that are going to be a bit fun, perhaps giving each other dares, or just playing bingo with the flying fish that land on the boat and seeing who can win the most squares, for example. So really silly things.
So that's the mental side of doing this. You need a mental hardness, which you're sketching a regime there that most people in their daily lives just wouldn't even contemplate. But let's just talk about the physical side of it. You're going to row for 8 months. You'll have occasional stops, so they're not going to be for very long. So for most of this 8 months, you're going to be rowing. Have you any idea of your daily calorie expenditure, that sort of thing, what it's going to do to you physically?
We'll actually be rowing for about 15 hours each day, which on its own is kind of a big thing. But bearing in mind that none of us are particularly sporty, none of us had ever rowed before. We've only been training and learning to row since January. So it's kind of an added level of kind of requirements.
My mouth has just hit my desk here. I had in my head that you were a rower since childhood. My goodness, that is astonishing.
No, and the kind of the ironic thing is, two of us come from Henley-on-Thames, which has the oldest rowing club in the world. And actually, Lizzie's dad is one of the top Olympic coaches for rowing. So it's kind of ironic that neither of us have rowed before, and we're just having to learn now. And we're just taking those kind of very painfully slow steps of working out how to make the stroke properly and how to try and row at the same time. So we've still got quite a long way to go, but it's all the process of building up, really. And I guess in terms of preparation for that, we've been rowing on the ergo since January, building up from rowing for 5 minutes at a time and up to kind of 2 hours at a time. So we're kind of going through a whole big process of just getting ourselves generally fit and just getting our bodies used to kind of different challenges. But actually on the row itself, we'll probably use up about 8,000 calories each day, but your body can't absorb that much even if you try to eat that many calories. So the only thing you can really do to prepare for that is to put on lots of weight before you go, and know that you'll lose it, especially when you're seasick for the first few weeks as well.
That's quite remarkable. So you're training to get a level of fitness.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you are trying to, for lack of a better phrase, get fat.
Definitely, that's exactly it.
this is the most bizarre health and fitness regime I've ever heard of, but I can understand where it's coming from. So
it's probably the best bit of training, to be honest. You know, we actually have an excuse to eat lots of cake. I'm sure there'll be nutritionists out there going, you need to be doing this and you need to be doing that. But to us, it's just, you know, we still want to keep an element of fun. So yeah, it's probably the one time in our lives where we can eat anything we want and not really worry too much about it.
Yeah, that's great. You've just been eating complete bars of chocolate going, look, I'm in training. What are you doing? leave me alone. I can eat all this stuff. I need it.
Exactly. We do get some envious looks at times for that part of our training.
How much fat do you have to actually have then? Have you set yourself a goal for, this is almost like reverse Weight Watchers.
Yeah.
Have you got a goal for how much you need to put on before you go?
We think about 2 stone each, roughly.
And how many calories does that equate to? Do you have any idea of that?
No. just jump on the scales every so often and, you know, have a bit of a pinch of our skin and, you know, are we feeling fat enough yet? And do we need to eat some more? And I mean, to be honest, we'll probably work more with a nutritionist towards the row. I mean, we're still Well, we're 10 months away still, and a lot of the fat will go on to just, you know, because we're trying to get fit as well at the moment. We're not too worried about putting the calories on now, but as we get closer to the road, that's when we'll really start to try and, you know, put the fat on.
What kind of food will you have with you to eat to, you know, because obviously it's got to be high in carbs, I would presume.
Yeah. Before we actually even ship the boat from the UK to California, we have to pack most of our food provisions. So we have to pack a bag for each of us for each day of the row. And within each of our bags, we'll have a mixture of kind of dehydrated food, which we need to add water to. And then we'll have some wet foods as well for times when, for example, the weather's really bad and we can't kind of boil that water, or just in case the water maker breaks and we don't have water to add into the food. And then within those bags as well, we'll have lots of different snacks and things that we want to eat. And kind of on top of that, we've got some, they're called Sproutamo. They're kind of little tubs that you grow different kind of bean sprouts and things in, which will give us a little bit of fresh stuff and some extra protein as well, which is kind of our luxury item really, but will hopefully help us to avoid things like constipation and, you know, all those things which wouldn't be very good when you're rowing.
And how prone to seasickness are the four of you?
So far, none of us have ever experienced seasickness. Thankfully, Kate's in the Royal Navy, so she's actually doing a lot of her training at sea. She's been on Illustrious for quite a while, and she's been practicing on her rowing machine in the bottom of a ship, which is quite funny. So she's probably got the best training of all of us. Yeah, none of us have been seasick before, but we have been told that we will be seasick just because our boat's quite light and we're quite low in the water, and some of the waves could be about 30 foot high, particularly in storms, and sometimes we won't be able to actually see over the waves. So I think from a kind of sports psychology point of view, that's actually harder for us in some ways, because even though we've all been at sea in rough times, we've never experienced that. We don't really know what it's going to feel like to be seasick. I mean, Kate originally trained for, she had a role as a pilot's assistant, so she was training to be on fast jet. So she's had to go on lots of like almost centrifuge kind of things. So, and she got sick only when they were going very, very fast. So yeah, I think that's going to be one of the really difficult things to kind of prepare for. But we are working with a homeopath locally who's helping us to come up with lots of different things that we can take. For example, if we have lots of ginger, it might help us to avoid that. And then just for the first few weeks at sea, we'll be eating lots of tinned peaches and tinned fruit, because they're a little bit less nasty when you're sick, so as they come up.
I love the planning that's going into this. You know, we're going to eat this food because when it comes back up, it won't taste as bad. That is a detail. Now, a lot of people listening to this are going to be going, "Oh my goodness, the word unsupported has been mooted here." What happens if things do go wrong, Sarah? Because this is actually, for all the you know, the courage involved in this and the good intentions of doing the scientific work and education, that there is a risk involved in this. This isn't a stroll in the park. What is in place to help you if you do get into trouble?
Well, the reason that we signed up for the race part of the row was actually, I mean, it probably costs us more by taking part, but because we are taking part, we'll actually have a lot more support and a really good opportunity to kind of get some extra experience, because as much as we try and prepare, you know, we're still not really going to know what it's like until we get there. So it doesn't matter how much planning you put into that. While we're at sea, we have a tracking device attached to the boat the whole time. And that's what people will be able to use to follow us. But we also have personal devices called EPIRB. So if there is a problem, those will go off, and that will set about a whole process of rescue. So that signal will get sent to UK Coast Guards, who will then alert our main person, who will then set a whole planning process and set about the rescue. But obviously, because we are in the Pacific, it could take 29 hours, it could take a few days, and if the weather's bad, it might mean that people can't actually get to us. So that's where that relationship with the boat is very, very important, and remembering to close the hatches as well, because that's probably one of the biggest risks.
So when exactly are you leaving, Sarah? And what can people do for you now? Where can they find out about you and what can they help you with?
Well, right now we're in the fundraising part of the row, which is probably everybody tells us is the hardest part of the row, and just to get the start line is a really tough bit, and probably almost tougher than actually doing the row itself. There's certainly quite good mental preparation. We do have a list of kit on the website, which people can look at. The website's www.fourbirdsofboating.com.
Is four, is that written out or is that a numeral?
It's written out. And then for the charity, our website is www.oceansproject.com. And then we're looking for people to become a friend. So you can become a friend, for which you receive updates, you get a mug or a teddy bear, and you get to come to events and write your name on the boat, and that costs £25. So we're looking for people to come become a friend. You can also sponsor us just in general. You can sponsor the charities directly. Obviously, that then goes to the charities. And then we're looking for corporate sponsorship. So I think to be a bronze supporter, for example, is £1,000, up to headline sponsorship of £10,000. So yeah, different things available there. And really, it's just about promotion as well. So the whole reason we're doing the row is to promote and raise money for the three children's charities.
That's phenomenal. And when is your start date again, Sarah?
The 7th of June, 2014.
And you hope to finish then?
Around December. Next year, yes.
Home in time for Christmas.
Yeah, well, we actually won't be, because we'll be in Thailand, kind of visiting all the orphans there who lost family in a tsunami. So we'll be in Thailand first and then coming back.
Well, Sarah, I think, my goodness, there'd be so many people following you, and just best wishes for a very safe and very productive journey. I think everybody who listens to this podcast is certainly going to be following you, because what an undertaking. What an undertaking.
Thank you.
Behind the Pixels is produced by the Digital Storyteller. Thank you.